good evening. Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, and for the next hour, those of Mr. Amos Holbrook, and we're going to be talking about his book, The Deporter. And it's a fascinating book because Mr. Holbrook was a deportation officer, and most of you have no idea what that is, but you will before the hour is over. Now, one of the things I would point out is that when the United States was about to invade Iraq, one of the parting things that Saddam did before he disappeared initially was to release about 50,000 hardened criminals from his prisons. Why? Well, because, of course, they were going to do what criminals always do, commit crimes, and it was going to make, of course, Iraq even more difficult to govern with all of those criminals loose in the society over and above the war that was going on. Sidney, when Fidel Castro wanted to get back in the United States, why, of course, when we had a lot of people coming to the United States during the Carter administration, Fidel Castro opened all of his insane asylums and all of his prisons for hardened criminals and shipped them into the United States. And suddenly we've got all of these criminals here and insane people we want to send them back, and Fidel Castro won't take them back. So if you want to disrupt a society, what you do is you have a lot of hardened criminals that you have to release into the community. And that's exactly the position that Mr. Holbrook found himself on. And so I'm going to let him tell you a little bit about his background, how it was that he came to be a deportation officer, and then what he encountered as one of the 60 deportation officers, and eventually held one of the key positions in this division, trying to send back criminal aliens to their countries and certainly get them out of the United States. And the total frustration he encountered. Amos, thank you so very much for being with us again.
Hey, thank you very much, Dr. Stan. It's always a pleasure.
Why don't you just sort of go ahead and give the background of certainly who you are, how it was that you came to be a deportation officer, and then what you encountered when you tried to do a good job then protect the American people.
Okay, Dr. Stan. Well, to tell you about my origins, I grew up as an Army brat, believing very strongly in America and what she stood for. And I joined the Army myself later on in life and spent 4 years. I served overseas. And after that, I came back to the States and I thought, what is there good for me to do over here? And I heard about a job that an Army friend of mine did. He wrote me up and said, Ames, there's a job that I found that I'm doing now called deportation officer, and I think you'd really like it a lot. The purpose of the deportation officer is to remove deportable criminal aliens from the United States, he told me. What we do is we go out and we identify the criminals who come from other countries and are running around America committing crimes here. And we identify them, and we apprehend them, and we put them in front of an immigration judge, and then the judge orders them removed. And there are some appeals, but once that's done, the order becomes final, and we bring them home.
And that sounds so simple, you know. It sounds logical, but of course that's not the way the system really works. And so I'm going to let you tell the story of really, of course, what happened when you get there. You get a job, but then you begin to find out that there are people in our government, the highest levels, who don't want to send the criminals home. They want them released into our society. These are people who are murderers, rapists, and you were ordered then, of course, to release them.
Exactly right.
Go right ahead.
Well, the scenario that my friend described to me was accurate up to that point. But actually, there was a disconnect where after these guys got their orders of removal, after these aggravated felons were ordered by an immigration judge to return to their homeland, and in their files sat a legally binding warrant of deportation that it was my job to execute, I found that the next step was not so easy, because we need to seek permission from these other countries to send their criminals back. In the system that we have right now, if we just put them on the plane and bring them back home with no travel document that identifies them as belonging to their country of origin, then their country of origin will just send us right back on the plane. So President George Bush quote before we went to war with Iraq, and he said, "America will never seek a permission slip to defend the security of our nation." And it sounds great, and it's words that we should live by as Americans, but unfortunately, in this case, we are asking permission to secure our nation. And these countries, when we ask permission, oftentimes tell us no. You may not send our criminals back. We don't want them. And from that point, our government has a policy that says we must let them go.
And the thing is, of course, we could put pressure on these countries. There's lots of things that we could do
if
we really wanted to, but we don't do that. We could just say, you're not going to send anybody into our country, then we're going to cut off all visas for you. We're going to cut off all trade for you. You take your criminals back. We're not going to be stuck with them. But even if, we were not going to do that, why would you ever create a policy where you would let hardened criminals, convicted criminals, murderers and rapists loose in our society? It really didn't make sense to me, and I guess it didn't make sense to you either, did it?
No, it didn't make sense at all, Dr. Stan. So I tried to make sense of it and still get these guys out of our country. So I tried to rewrite the rules and make some deals and impersonate some officials and crack down on these countries myself, and I had a lot of success in doing that, but unfortunately the release machine was still in high gear.
Hold that, we'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course what happened was that Ames got the job working as a deportation officer, and the problem was, though, that after the judge had said, yes, this man is to be deported, I mean, after all, he's a murderer, he's a rapist, and then, of course, they would, the country would say, we're not going to take him back without travel documents, and that's, they call them TDs, and we're not going to give you a travel document to bring this criminal back to our country. We don't want this man. He's a criminal. He's your problem. And, of course, then Ames would say, well, you know, but you've got to take him back. He's yours. And, of course, what would happen if the countries would not take them back, and some countries had a policy they would not take back any, like Cuba, I believe Vietnam, Laos, they wouldn't take back any of their criminals. But, of course, many of the others would simply make up excuses. Why would they want to take a hardened criminal and put him into their community? But here in the United States, if they couldn't get a travel document, they were ordered to release these hardened criminals. They couldn't even send them back to the state where they'd been tried and convicted and sentenced to life imprisonment. And so you pick up the story, and suddenly when you become aware of the fact that there seem to be people in Washington, D.C. intent upon releasing criminals into our community, what did you do? Certainly you had some success with certain countries. Why don't you tell some of the stories?
Okay, well, I one of them fell into my lap at one point. There was a citizen of Antigua, and he was at a certain jail that I went to it was out in the middle of the swamp, out in Louisiana, and I went out there, and the deputy told me, oh, by the way, this particular detainee would like to talk to you, Claude Simmons. And by the way, he's in the suicide cell. And I said, oh, suicide cell, that's no good. Why didn't you tell me before? One of our detainees is trying to kill himself. We have to know. We have to take care of him. And the deputy told me, oh, no, don't worry. We're just moving him around, and he's in the suicide cell right now, just temporarily, until we find a room for him in the dorm. And so I thought to myself, what can we do with that? So I called up his consulate, and I told him that this man was about to commit suicide, and that it was going to be an international incident, and it was going to come out that Antigua had not given him his travel document, even though he desperately wanted to go home. And because of that, the man had killed himself. Well, at that point, the chief of police over there, the man in charge of issuing travel documents, said, okay, you're going to get a travel document on him right away. So look for it in the FedEx envelope tomorrow. So that was one down, and that began a sort of a whirlwind ride of the lies that I could tell and the tricks that I could pull. But the downside to that was I was a law enforcement officer. This isn't some catch-me-if-you-can freelancer who's just some guy off the street pretending to do things. I was an enforcer who'd sworn to uphold the rules, so it really wore on me. And meanwhile, I'm surrounded by other deportation officers who face the same frustrations that I do, but they were staying within the rules, even if it meant they lost more cases. They were performing their jobs in an honorable manner.
Well, I think the significant thing was that these criminals were all pretty smart, and they didn't want to go home. This fellow didn't want to go back to Antigua. He knew that if he objected to it, maybe, of course, his country would not take him back. And sooner or later, no matter how terrible and horrible his crime was, he was going to be released. So they all understood this, and many of them would even deny that they were citizens of a foreign country. They would refuse to give you a passport. They would refuse to give you a birth certificate. They would refuse to do anything that would allow you to know what country they came from so they could be deported. And they were simply playing games with you, weren't they?
You're right about that, Dr. Stan. That's exactly what was happening. So these guys, they have all the time in the world. They're sitting in jail, and they're thinking of ways to stay there until you kick them out. They're thinking of ways to beat you on their deportation. So while you're writing a consulate and saying, this guy is in our jails and he needs to go home, this guy is writing letters telling them the opposite, telling them he's actually a citizen of some other country, and don't listen to this crazy deportation officer who says, I want to go home because I am not even a citizen of your country. And I think if he sent you any documents that show otherwise, those documents are forged, and this and that. And some of these guys even photo-substituted passports from other countries and Xeroxed them, and they would send them to the countries they were actually from, saying, hey, look, I'm not from your country, I'm from this one. See, here's my passport. And they'd do whatever they could so that even if I was dealing with an honest country that was trying to help me out, and the country saw, oh, this is a passport from a different country. This guy is not from our country, so we're going to discontinue this line of questioning right now.
And, of course, the problem was that a lot of the countries just didn't want the criminals back.
That's right.
They were going to stick them in America. Now, you had pretty good relationships, though, of all things, with communist China. I thought that was really rather interesting, that in many respects they were far more respectful and willing to work with you than many of the other countries.
That's absolutely right. I have to say that the consul general that was the vice consul that I worked with from the People's Republic of China consulate in Houston was an honorable man, and he always told me the truth, and usually the truth was not good news, but when he did tell me that I was going to get a travel document from him, it always came, and I booked the flight. And eventually I ended up making a deal with him because he wanted a certain alien who had been convicted of opium possession. He wanted this guy released to the streets in America because he had a family in America and he thought it was the humane thing to do. And this guy was otherwise a good working guy who didn't have a lot of problems. And first I bristled at the idea. I'm not going to release some guy. It's bad enough when my own government makes me release these criminals. But now some foreign government's asking me to do it. But then I realized that my own government was about to let the same guy loose anyway. So I turned this into a sort of a deal and said, well, maybe you can take back this double murderer who's been languishing here and we're about to have to let out. And maybe if the double murderer goes back to Beijing, then maybe this particular alien who's guilty of opium possession might just find his way to freedom. And that was the sort of beginning of our professional relationship that led me into a nice world of Chinese aggravated felons going back to their home country.
And, of course, what they would do, they would actually have one or two deportation officers with each one of these criminals on the plane, and they would actually fly them back. They would get them through customs or whatever would be there, but they had to have that travel document. And the travel document was the key. And if the country would not give a travel document, then he had no way of getting rid of the criminal. And he was going to be able to stay in America and be set free. As I read your book, I just have this terrible feeling of frustration that you must have felt. And really, you did an excellent job with the book because you were able to transmit to me the feeling of frustration you felt.
I appreciate that, Dr. Stan, because that's what I'm hoping to convey. And I hope that readers get very frustrated, and I hope they contact their congressman and our president, and they tell them that this needs to end now, and that if these congressmen and this president doesn't end it, then they're going to lose their power. Well, I guess the president's going to be on his way out anyway, but anybody he endorses, and all these representatives, all these senators who are running for re-election, they're not going to stop this right now, then somebody new is going to come in their place, that's for sure.
But I think that the important message of the book is this, that there are people in Washington, D.C. who are ordering deportation officers all across America to turn violent criminals loose, knowing full well that these violent criminals, most of them, are going to go right back to the life of violent crime. And certainly it doesn't make sense. I mean, why would any rational person do that sort of thing? I mean, a double murder, a rapist, but it doesn't really matter whether it makes sense. This is what's going on in our society. And until we understand that there really are people who have a different worldview, none of this makes sense. And I'm sure that Ames, when he was there on the front lines of this battle, of course, he must have been totally frustrated. One of the stories I really loved that you told about was this one rather obnoxious fellow, I think he was from Guyana, where you actually pretended to be the fellow saying you wanted to come home and you're going to pay the guy. The fellow that, you want to tell that about the $10,000, what was that about?
That you're absolutely right. Hambrick Ramkishun from Guyana. And his country refused to take him, and this guy had been belligerent from the minute we got him off the plane. We got a plane load of 53, our portion of the plane load. We had a couple of big planes come in from Philadelphia full of aggravated felons destined for our jails, all of Philadelphia's problem cases, because New Orleans, not only did we get the aliens off the streets in our own community, and Lord knows in New Orleans we had enough of those, but we also had cheap jails in Louisiana, so other districts around the country like to send us their riffraff.
And, of course, what happened was this fellow really rubbed you the wrong way, and he was going to play the system, and he was going to just stay there so long that you'd be forced to release him, and he'd be home free. He'd go back to the life of crime. And so we're going to go to a break. I'll quickly tell the story. What happened was that Ames pretended to be this guy, called the official in Guyana, and offered to give him $10,000 if he'd take him home. And they got the travel document, they sent him home, and you ask the question, I wonder what's going to happen, but he gets off the plane, and the fellow wants his $10,000. We'll try to find out what happened, if you ever heard the rest of the story, when we get back. Did you ever find out what happened to that fellow?
I never did, Dr. Stan, and I was one of those where I never looked back. And as you recall from having read the book, at that time...
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a 4-tape or a 4-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer Iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets, a little protects your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
You got headaches? Most headaches are caused by a structural weakness of blood vessels in the head, and the blood vessels are tending to balloon, causing a headache. The structural weakness is due to a deficiency. Correct the deficiency, and the body will heal itself. I blended what I believed to be the missing nutrients in the right proportions, and the headaches went away. When they were gone, they stayed gone. I named it Headache Stay Gone. See HeadacheStayGone.com or call 800-327-0727 for more information or to place an order. I'll send you a bottle of Headache Stay Gone. Headache Stay Gone will cure your headaches and prevent them from coming back before you pay the bill. Headache Stay Gone has already cured the worst migraines I have ever heard of. Call 800-327-0727. All orders are shipped the same day. Call 800-327-0727. That's 800-327-0727.
Hi, this is Dr. Tony Teary. Are you one of the many people who take vitamin supplements? Do you take handfuls of pills each day to increase energy, reduce your pain, or improve your overall health? Now there is a better way to get the vitamins and minerals your body needs in a delicious-tasting whole food liquid supplement, Body Balance. Body Balance contains 121 essential vitamins and minerals and is made from only organic and natural sources. Developed by doctors, Body Balance was originally available only through healthcare professionals. Now this incredible whole food liquid supplement can be delivered directly to your home. Body Balance offers an extremely effective method to feed your body towards wellness, and we're confident you'll love the difference your body feels. To order your Body Balance, call me directly at 1-800-768-9763 and try it risk-free for 45 days. Again, that's 1-800-768-9763 or online at healthyfoundations.net.
Guyana. And in Guyana, why, of course, they just said, well, you're not going to be able to send any more people here. We will not issue any visas for anybody from Guyana. If you will not take back your hardened criminals, we will not let anybody from your country come. So immediately when this happened, Guyana began taking back their hardened criminals. And then, of course, when they got word of that in Washington, D.C., they reversed the policy. And, of course, once they reversed the policy, then Guyana once again said, we're not going to take back our hardened criminals. They're your problem. And, of course, This could have been done all over the world, as Ames points out. All we had to do was say, no more foreign aid for your country, no more military aid from your country. You were going to play by the rules, international rules, or worse than you got to hold your feet to the fire. Unfortunately, there were people in Washington, D.C., who did not want to get rid of these hardened criminals, who wanted them released back into our community, and every day Ames would get more and more of these letters insisting that he release the hardened criminals. They certainly certainly laughed at you when you were forced to release them, didn't they? They understood how the game was played, and they understood all they had to do was block their deportation, and they could stay here as free men. That's so incredible.
I agree. It's incredible, Dr. Stan. And they sure did laugh at us, and they came out of those cells on release day, and they just, you saw their chest puffed out, and they knew they were victors. They walked as if they owned the world, and we sure did give it to them. We let them return to the streets of America to resume what they'd been doing before when they were committing crimes, and it was a brand new day for these guys all over again.
And of course, for our listener out there who finds this story difficult to believe, I think that the book, The Deporter, that's The Deporter. Ames was a deportation officer. It is an excellent read, and we're going to carry the book simply because I want people to understand that this is exactly what our officials who are trying to do a good job are up against. They used to have a reference to catch and release. They did that with a lot of the people that come in from other countries, and they were actually, they were apprehended coming in illegally, and they were caught. And then we released them and told them to come back to get for a deportation hearing. Of course, they wouldn't come back. So why would you bother to pick up people and then immediately release them into the community? It doesn't make sense. But at least most of these people, under those circumstances, even though they were coming into the country illegally, were not hardened criminals. What we're talking about, as far as Ames is concerned, is he's dealing with hardened, convicted criminals being turned loose on the streets of America. I don't think the average individual has any idea what's going on, do you?
No, Dr. Stan, I don't think so, but they do now, right? You're starting
to put
the word out
there.
I hope
they do. How is the book going? Are you on a book tour of some sort?
I certainly am. I'm doing some radio shows. I always enjoy spending time with you. I know I get to see you again sometime shortly.
Yeah, well, we wanted to get you onto all of our various networks because I think your story is so vitally important because it is so incredible. I mean, if I were to tell the average individual the story that you tell, they would say, that couldn't be true. Our government wouldn't, high government officials, the courts would not be ordering deportation officers to release hardened rapists and criminals and multiple murderers. And yet, of course, that's exactly what this story is all about. And that's why we're going to be carrying the book, The Deporter. If you want interested in getting it, we'll tell you later how to get that. Do you have a web page or anything of that sort?
There is a web page of some kind. I think it's thedeporter.us. My movie producer just called me recently, the producer who bought the movie rights, and said, hey, we just put up a website. I haven't had a chance to check it out yet. I'm on the road. But I understand thedeporter.us is a website. But the book itself is available all over the place, all the bookstores and, online.
And it's an excellent read. Some books are a little hard to read. This one's not hard to read at all. And are they going to make it into a motion picture?
That's the plan, Dr. Stan. We probably won't see it for a couple of years, but that's what's going on right now.
Well, I think it's an important story for people to understand. And if you look at things from a logical point of view, and you're, of course, a regular listener to Radio Liberty, and we often point out, if you look at something from a logical point of view, and it is not logical, then there has to be another explanation. And we're going to be back to that in just a moment or two with Mr. Ames Holbrook. If you have any questions at all, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Thank you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and yes, it really was interesting that you were saying, you know, in your book, talking about there were about only 6 deportation officers to cover the entire area from Texas all the way into Florida. You were chronically understaffed, weren't you?
Yeah, that's the truth, Dr. Stan, and I think that if we'd had even the full strength of deportation officers at any given time, it would have been challenging enough, right? Particularly since we were recycling these criminals back into the streets. But with the staff shortage, it was even more remarkable, and we were stretched even thinner.
And of course, you know, when you talk to people about this sort of thing, what sort of response do you get from the average individual when you tell them the story, you know, as you've told it to me? Do they sort of look at you a little askance, like, that couldn't really be going on in America?
And Dr. Stan, I often feel like I think people regard me the same way they do the guy I've seen on several shows who talks about the controlled demolition of the World Trade Center. He says that George Bush blew up the Twin Towers with dynamite. I think people think I'm a conspiracy theorist, just like that guy. Like, people cannot believe our government would harm us this way. And unfortunately, in this case, in the case of our government releasing these hardened felons from other countries into our streets, it's true.
Well, of course, it really isn't the government. It's a few people that are working there. Most of the people who are involved are simply carrying out the orders that they get. And just as you, in the hierarchy of the deportation office, ordinarily carried out your orders. Of course, sometimes you did stress the rules just a little bit, or quite a bit. But you know, you were trying to do what you were supposed to do. But most of the people who were sending these release orders were simply carrying out their directives.
Right.
But somebody had made the decision that we were going to do everything they could to disrupt the lawful structure of our society, because nobody could be that stupid that they would release these hardened criminals. They had to know exactly how this was going to contribute to this sense of lawlessness that's growing in our country.
You're exactly right, Dr. Stan. And the agency that's now ICE, deportation officers, are the smallest enforcement arm within ICE, which is Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which is in turn inside the Department of Homeland Security. This outfit, deportation officers, are highly trained and highly motivated. They're a law enforcement unit unsurpassed. But you're right, it is orders coming from
above them. Hold that thought right there, please. Well, this is Arthur Stain, to Stan, and certainly our guest today is Ames Holbrook. And we're talking about his book, The Deporter. The Deporter, and it's a story of a deportation officer who is placed into the unenviable position of having the responsibility to deport criminal aliens. Now, they may have come in the country illegally, or they may have come in the country legally, but be that as it may, they have committed terrible crimes. And of course, the logical thing would be either to keep them in our jails indefinitely, but a lot of the states didn't want to have to do that. They didn't want to have to pay for these people to be in prison for the rest of their lives, so they'd turn them over, of course, to the Immigration Department to be deported, and then, of course, they couldn't deport them because the countries of origin wouldn't take them back, or the people would lie about the country of origin, or they would not provide any proof of citizenship in a foreign country. And now, was this a very common thing that the states would actually turn these criminals over to you because they wanted to get them off their books?
Dr. Stan, I don't know the percentage of those, but certainly it did happen. But let's not forget the states did it in good faith, believing that we would deport these criminals. So they were not; it was not irresponsible behavior on their part to turn them over early, even when they did, because the states believed, the prisons believed, oh, we're turning them over to immigration, and immigration's going to deport them. So they're going to be out of our country, and they're not going to harm people here anymore. Well, unfortunately, as we know, not all these guys could be deported, because the usual problems. Our government liberated them on our soil before we had a chance to deport them to their home countries, because their home countries would refuse to take them back.
And I think certainly what eventually got to Ames is when he sat back, and as hard as it worked, and as many rules as he may have bent a little bit here, there, and elsewhere, to get these criminals out of our country, when he calculated what it was happening, he was losing far more than he was gaining. In other words, far more criminals were and professional criminals were being released onto our streets than that he was able to deport, and under a tremendous amount of stress, and I'm sure very, very concerned about the consequences of what he was doing. Because if you simply played by the rules, you'd never get a lot of these people out of the country. The other countries wouldn't take them back. And so perhaps with a little ingenuity on his part, he was able to get rid of many of the hardened criminals, but there were far more that, of course, were being released. And when you tell people that they're intentionally releasing hardened criminals onto our streets, people say, oh, no, that could not happen. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you would like to give us a call, you have a question or comment on this incredible story. But the book is well worthwhile reading, because it is simply one more example of the things we talk to you about here so often, the things that just don't make sense. And yet, here in America, why, of course, there's an increasing tempo of violence and criminal activity, and certainly even in Northern California, where I live, which has traditionally been very quiet, and no gangs, no murders, and suddenly that's all changing. And the gangs are here, and the MS-13 is here, and the drive-by shootings are here, and of course, increasingly, we're moving out into a period of chaos and crisis. Well, certainly, we've got Bruce calling from Spokane, so let's go to Bruce. If our producer will just go ahead and put him on there. Hi, Bruce. How are you doing?
I'm doing very good, Dr. Stan.
You enjoying the
program? Wonderful to hear you again.
Okay.
Yes, I'd like to ask Ames a question, if I may.
Go right ahead.
Of course, Bruce.
Ames, do you have the names of the people in the hierarchy that are ordering these releases? Not your jailers, not your the lowerlings that are responding to those orders, but the ones that are actually ordering those.
Well, Bruce, it's as Dr. Stan said, even those folks writing the release letters are, those folks in the headquarters are writing release letters because they're carrying out the orders of the highest in charge.
And who are they? That's the that's the important thing.
Well, we can
know those people.
You're talking about the very highest level. So we really have to go to we can find out the names on the website. We can go to the top Homeland Security and the top of ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. But I know that even those folks on some level are following what they consider the law.
And it really wasn't some of this actually decisions made by the United States Supreme Court?
Exactly. Well, the Supreme Court is who decided we could not detain these folks endlessly. But there's no reason that our taxpayers should be paying to detain these guys endlessly in the first place, because our president and our Congress should have leaned on these countries and told them, you will take your citizens back.
So I think that, of course, if you want to know who's responsible, it's the Supreme Court, it's George Bush, and the leaders of both the House and the Senate. It would be a very simple thing to solve the problem. They don't want a solution, they want a problem. Anything
well, I understand, it's the dialectic approach of problem, reaction, solution. The endless thing, they caused the problem, proposed the solution, and it's the solution they wanted in the first place. It's chaos, which leads to more control.
I think you may be onto something there, Bruce. Anything else you'd like to say?
Nothing that you haven't found out earlier.
All right, fine. Thanks so much for calling.
You bet.
Bye-bye. And, of course, Bruce obviously is a regular listener to Radio Liberty, and he's about two steps ahead of what we're talking about. Our telephone number, again, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California, at 464-8295. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And this is really an incredible story of certainly a man with ingenuity and trying to do certainly his job as best he can. What do you think would ever happen to you, if they never found some of the things that you were doing?
I believe my badge was at risk probably ever since the meeting with ever since the agreement with the Chinese vice consul out of Houston. I think from that point on, it would have been the worst professionally. I think I would have lost my badge.
But of course, you actually were eventually promoted into even a more responsible position, weren't you? You were certainly one of the key people in the department at the time when you finally resigned, weren't you?
Yes, that's true. That's true. I was heading up the aggravated felon division in New Orleans, and that was an extremely important position, especially for somebody who had not reached his journeyman level in his career. I was given this responsibility because I did a lot of good work, and I think based on results that's where I should have been. But when I rewrote the rules, I would have suffered the consequences had I been found out.
Well, of course, the thing is that this was a good-paying job. It had a lot of benefits to it. Wasn't it sort of hard to give up a good-paying job with pension and health care benefits and all the things that went with that, actually just go out and be more or less on your own, write a book? Or I don't even know if you were planning on writing a book at the time, but I'm certainly glad that you did. But it must have been an awfully difficult decision to just turn your back on something you enjoyed, because you did enjoy it.
You're right, Dr. Stan, you're right, and I thought it was worthwhile. I knew I did a lot of good, and the job did compensate me very well. I lived in New Orleans, which was not an expensive place to live, unlike where you are out there, Dr. Stan.
Right? Yes.
And I was very much rewarded by the job, and I felt good about my accomplishments, and it was tough to leave. And not only that, I left a lot of good friends still doing a dangerous job and still on the front lines there, and I felt bad in leaving them in the war zone, if you will. So there was a lot that troubled me about leaving.
Yeah, but there were a lot of stresses, and other people, of course, had the same sort of problems that, just kind of tremendous stress, and they just couldn't take the stress, and of course, they had emotional problems. It wasn't that you had emotional problems. It was simply that you realized that this was really not productive. It was sort of like, like spinning your wheels, almost as if you're doing everything you can, but you're not getting ahead. The bad guys are winning. And I think this is really the message that you'll get if you read Ames' book, that the bad guys are winning because they have very close allies and key people in positions in government. And if you read the book through, you come away with that conclusion, it just doesn't make sense. And as Bruce, who was called in here a few minutes ago, said that there obviously must be another reason behind it. Well, our telephone number again, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. Are you getting on any of the large television programs at all, or are you doing mostly just small radio stations or networks?
Dr. Stan, I'm doing a lot of big ones, and I have tonight I was on Hannity and Colbert.
Oh, great! They got a great listening audience.
So I was on television for that, and that was. That was very interesting, so I think we're going to get the word out to a wide audience.
What was the response of the hosts there? Were they receptive to your message?
I think both of them were, actually, and I was on Alan Colmes' radio show last night, and he was terrific. He seemed to believe that this is an issue that we should all agree on, no matter how we feel about immigration's other issues, and also that this is the first one we must resolve. This absolutely is the biggest immigration emergency facing our country right now.
Well, the interesting thing is that I've got my ear pretty well to the ground. I've got a lot of contacts all over the country. And it wasn't until I read your book that I really realized this element of the problem. I knew about the catch and release program, which didn't make sense. And of course, if they're from other countries, you catch them and release them. If they're from Mexico, why, of course, you catch them and send them back to Mexico so they can try to come in again. These are not hardened criminals. I mean, is the idea that we are being forced, and that you, as a deportation officer, were forced to release hardened criminals, that is the revelation. And, of course, I'm just hoping and praying that your message, as it gets out to Hannity and the others, you know, will begin to get people thinking, because this is, well, as you say, I mean, it just sounds as incredible as some of these conspiracy theorists out there. And yet, of course, you're speaking from first-hand experience and a message and a story that the average American has not heard before. So I think that that's really what's so vitally important. How long ago did you actually leave the service?
That was April of 2002, Dr. Stan. And I had come in a little under 4 years earlier, and it looked to be a career for me. And I think it's a good career for people who believe in the mission, and I still think that we're going to make it perfect, and that is by allowing deportation officers to do their job.
Well, now, of course, has anything changed at all since you left? I'm sure you must have contact with Phil and some of the other people that you know.
Right, you're right. I sure do have contact with Phil, and I have contact with all those guys that I worked with before, and they're still fighting the fight, and those guys are the real deal, still putting their lives on the line every day for the rest of us. And a lot of those people, I won't mention them by name here, but a lot of those people really hope we get this word out to the people, and that the people put the pressure on the government, and the government changes this so the deportation officers can perform their mission to the fullest.
And, of course, the significant thing is if the people don't know there's a problem, all they see is the end result. They see rising crime rates and rising violence rates, and they say, we don't understand why these things are happening. I mean, here in a country like ours, I mean, we've got something like 7 million people in prison, probation or parole. Well, certainly with all those people in jail today or on probation or parole, why do we have the degree of crime that we have? And they don't understand, of course, that as hard as the deportation officer works, he is being blocked at every turn, not only by the other countries, but by the people who should be protecting America here from the criminal element. These are not simply illegal aliens. These are some of them may be legal, some of them may be illegal, but they are criminals. They're hardened criminals. And the last thing you want is to have these people on the streets continuing in their life of crime. And then, of course, we wonder why, of course, we can't get the drugs under control and why, of course, we still have the high rates of burglary and other violent crimes in our city. Well, there are any other stories that you'd like to tell our listeners? Because the book is just full of fascinating stories.
It is. I have a lot of stories from the job, and I don't know if I can tell them any better on the air than they play out in the book. But I can just say that it's a job that when you show up in the morning, you don't know what you're going to get, but you know it's going to be interesting, and you're going to come into contact with some interesting characters, and many of them may be unsavory, and you're going to have a day full of surprises, and you think that after a while you'd get used to the surprises, but no, the surprises keep coming, and I think that's one of the things that keeps the deportation officer going, is just the constant excitement and turnover and new faces.
And of course the thing is that a lot of these criminals are very smart people, and of course they're very they know exactly how the system works, and they're going to play the system because they know that if they can stall it long enough, they're going to go free. Now, of course, no other criminal in the United States who committed these terrible crimes would go free, but if you're a foreigner, you're from another country and you committed these crimes, and you can simply prevent them from deporting you, and you do that by saying, why, I'm an American citizen, or I'm not from from Guyana, I'm from I'm from Suriname or something like
right.
that. And so they would lie about their source of origin, and they would not come up with a passport, they would not come up with a birth certificate, and they all had them. In fact, it wasn't until you really were able to begin putting pressure on the people that by one devious means or another, that a lot of them then would come forward with their passports.
That's right, Dr. Stan, and I think at that point when they started coming forward with their passports, there was kind of a momentum to it because they wanted to play a role in their own destinies.
Remember, there's one fellow who was frightened to death that you were going to send him back to China, and you were going to send him to Beijing. And he was quite happy to go as long as it sent him to Shanghai. And of course, that was so interesting that in Beijing, of course, the police were so poorly played that, I mean, they would, of course, beat everybody up that came back, with a travel document and steal all their money. And this fellow was willing to go to Shanghai because he figured maybe he wouldn't be beat up and maybe he'd be able to keep his money. And didn't he even offer to take you to dinner after you took him there?
That's right. He offered to take me and my partner out to dinner and drink. We respectfully declined, but that was something. He was so happy that he got to actually come into his country and walk through the turnstiles and not be beaten and robbed of all the money that he'd.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, Ames, we've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program. What would you like to say to our listeners out across America?
Well, I would like to say thanks a lot for listening, and I hope they arm themselves with this knowledge, and if they want to make a difference, then they can take that information that they have and bring it to their representatives, bring it to their senators, and say, this must change. We refuse to accept foreign governments planting their dangerous criminals and maintaining them here in the United States. And
of course, I was really amazed, that if Vietnam was one of those countries, it wouldn't take them back, aren't they?
No, you had all three right, Dr. Stan. It's Vietnam, Laos, and Cuba.
All right, and of course, the thing is that we've given Vietnam most favored nation treaty status for trade. All we had to do was just say, you take your criminals back again, or we're going to cut off your trade, and we wouldn't do that. We wouldn't do anything to the countries that were really in violation of the spirit of international cooperation, refusing to take back the criminal element, and leaving them here where, of course, either we would have to pay for their being taken care of the rest of their lives or turn them loose on our society. And, of course, that was what was happening. Many of these people were being turned loose to go out in the community again and steal and rob. And, of course, you came into contact with a lot of these criminals after they'd been released, didn't you?
I sure did. I ran into them in my own community. And it was always a reminder that I was filling the country up with these people. I was just releasing them, and America was going to feel whatever these folks had to unleash on America, and that was not going to be good.
And, of course, certainly the incidence of violent crime keeps increasing, and the average individual has no idea that this is even a problem. And I really think that what you've done is a yeoman's task in writing the book, getting the information out, and, of course, bringing it to people's attention. So I want to thank you very much for being with us this evening, and I'm looking forward. I think it's in about 2 weeks we have you on our afternoon program, and then you'll have talked to all of our audiences. Ames, thanks very much for writing the book. Thanks very much for being a great guest.
Hey, Dr. Stan, thank you very much, and thanks a lot for having a great show.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Good night.
All right, fine. Well, that was Ames Holbrook. His book is The Deporter. It's called The Deporter, and it's an easy read. It's a fascinating book, and we're going to be carrying it just because I want people to read this and then to tell others about it. And, again, we'll tell you in a moment how to get it. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we hope many of you out there have enjoyed our conversation with Ames Holbrook. Have you ever heard this story before? And then about the federal officials being required by law to turn murderers and rapists loose in our society. And there are people in Washington, D.C., who, just as Saddam Hussein did when he was going to be invaded, he simply took all the criminals out of the prisons in Iraq and turned them loose to create chaos in his society so that when our troops moved in, Iraq would be even more ungovernable. And that's exactly what the people in Washington, D.C. are doing, and they know what they're doing. And certainly Ames makes a point that he had, Sidney and the other officers he worked with had tried over and over again to suggest what needed to be done, but believe me, the people in Washington, D.C. do not want a solution. They want the problem. The book, of course, is called The Deporter. It's available by calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Fascinating book. I hope very soon it's going to become a movie, and people will begin to understand the degree of deceit and treachery and deception at the highest levels of our government. And this doesn't mean that we don't love our government. It just means that the wicked people have taken over there, and to understand who the wicked people are, you need, of course, to read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. You need to hear my talk entitled The Forbidden Secret, and it comes with a syllabus. You need to see the DVDs, two award-winning DVDs, The Secret Mystery of America's Beginning, and Riddles in Stone, The Secret Architecture of Our Nation's Capital. And then, if you want, of course, verify the message of the Riddles in Stone, we carry a book. It's called The Secret Destiny of America. It's written by Mandy P. Hall, who is a Satanist. And it's not listed in our catalog nor on our page. You're going to have to, if you want to get it, you'll have to actually call us directly. We carry it because we want people who really want to understand there is a master plan. And as Mandy P. Hall says, for 3,000 years, secret societies have been working behind the scenes to bring about world democracy. And why are we fighting in Iraq today? To bring about world democracy. Well, this is the time when I really need to remind our listeners that that we are having an all-day conference here in the Monterey Bay area on the 28th of October. That's about 2.5 weeks from now. That's the Aptos Seascape Golf Course. Doors will open at 7:30. They'll be going until about 5:30. We're bringing in outside speakers. We think it's going to be a great meeting, and we do hope that many of you will be able to come. And if you can, of course, you're going to have a reservation because we're going to be serving lunch. If you'd like more information, the number to call is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And, of course, we have to know that people are coming because we have to tell them how many people are going to be there for lunch. So if you're going to come, why, please let us know. Again, 1-800-544-8927. We hope many of you will go to our website at radioliberty.com. You can listen to our programs there on the Internet live 4 hours a day, certainly on rebroadcast 9 hours a day on our stream at radioliberty.com. You can watch many of our DVDs there posted and free of charge. Of course, we hope many down the line you'll want to get them and show them to others. Now, these are DVDs that we've actually produced. You can read my newsletters, and of course you can, we put them together. We have a number of newsletters on the spiritual hierarchy that rules America. Who are the spiritual hierarchy? Where are the people, the masters of wisdom, the ancients of wisdom, the elder brothers? I mean, all you need to do is go up on the website of thelucistrust.org. thelucistrust.org, one of the most powerful organizations in America today, and I dare say most of you have never read about it, but they openly talk about the spiritual hierarchy that rules the world today. You can certainly get our free pamphlet set on the occult hierarchy. That's the occult hierarchy. Help us get the information out. We're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. So please pray for America. Pray for revival. Because if we don't turn back to God as a nation, we're going to lose this country. But lastly, please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And we need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and the views of our callers. And, well, the guest this evening is Mr. William Greig, formerly the senior editor of the New American Magazine, and now certainly working with the Welsh Society and certainly doing a lot of radio and writing. And he has his blog, and we'll tell you later how to get William Greig's information. But certainly one of our most exciting guests, one we always look forward to talking to every week, Mr. William Greig. Hi, William. How are you tonight?
Doing great, and it's always the highlight of my week to speak with you.
Well, thank you so much. Well, anyway, what are we going to talk about tonight? I know you're on top of all the things that are happening, and there's so many things that are happening all the time, but where are we going this evening?
I think a really good place to start would be to talk about this horrible episode that occurred a little more than a couple of weeks ago now in Phoenix with Carol Ann Gutbaum, the 45-year-old mother from New York who was flying to Tucson, Arizona. She was trying to go to a rehabilitation clinic. She had a very severe problem with alcohol. A lot of people do. Whenever we talk about the so-called war on drugs, I always find it peculiar that the most damaging drug, alcohol, is perfectly legal, although, of course, you have restrictions on time, place, and the volume you can consume of it. And there was an effort, of course, to prohibit the production and distribution and consumption of alcohol, and famously failed, and that was a number of decades ago. But you take a look at the amount of damage that is done by alcohol consumption, you've got to wonder why it is that people believe that government is competent to decide what recreational drugs people are going to be able to take, and instead of regulating what people do in terms of the violence they commit to other people, they try to regulate what people consume. That digression aside, Carol Gottbaum had a terrible problem with alcohol, apparently, and she also had a terrible problem with clinical depression, and she was suicidal, and she was a mother with three small children. After her last child was born a couple of years ago, she succumbed to postpartum depression, which is a very common thing, particularly when you're talking here about somebody who was already in her 40s by the time she had her last child. She is a woman who was born in South Africa, raised in London, the second wife, I believe, of a man from New York City, who's sort of the scion of a left-wing dynasty there, Noah Gutbaum. She wanted to get help. She had become suicidal. She was wrecking her life. She was in a real mess in terms of being a good wife and mother, so they were going to send her to, I believe it's called Cottonwoods del Sur, a hospital in Tucson, Arizona, that specializes in the treatment of depression and alcohol abuse. And so she got on a plane. She caught a late flight. Her children had been attending a private Jewish school in New York City. They were being sent to public school now because they were making arrangements in their budget so that she could get a very expensive rehabilitation program. She missed her direct flight to Tucson. She ended up having a connecting flight in Phoenix. Because she missed her direct flight, apparently, there was some concern about what would happen if she were wandering around the Sky Harbor Airport in Phoenix unattended, given the fact that she has a weakness for alcohol and these psychological problems. So her husband contacted a family friend in Phoenix and asked if he could go by the airport and just be with her to make sure that she was all right. Well, they missed connections because I guess the flight was late coming in. And while she was there trying to make sure that she caught her connecting flight, she was delayed by our good friends, the Transportation Security Administration, our friendly federal employee gropers. And so she managed to miss her connecting flight. And she was in the terminal there at Mesa Air.
Hold that thought, and we'll be right back here in just a moment.
She was at the terminal for a connecting flight on Mesa Air, which I guess is a regional airline in Arizona. and the flight had already filled up. And, of course, by this time, apparently she had made a visit to the airport bar, which is an unfortunate thing, but a predictable one, given the fact that her friend hadn't been able to make the connection to keep her out of the bar. She'd gotten something to eat and apparently consumed a small quantity of alcohol, but it doesn't take a whole lot when you're in the mood that she was already in, which was one of severe anxiety and depression. Having missed her direct flight and now having missed her connecting flight, she was on the verge of a breakdown. A gentleman there in the terminal very gallantly offered to give her his seat on the connecting flight to Tucson, which, of course, is the sort of thing you would expect a gentleman to do. He said, "I'll take the next one. You take this one." Whereupon, Carol Ann was informed that this wasn't acceptable because it would be a security breach if she were to do so. And at this point, she dissolved into a heap of frustration and anxiety, plaintively wailing that she's not a terrorist. She's a poor, pathetic, sick housewife who was trying to get help. And she had a world historic breakdown there in the terminal, which is understandable given the amount of pressure that she was under. The airline or the TSA, I'm not able to determine which, called the police. The police showed up. And as is usually the case, the police decided to calm her fears and assuage her anxieties by treating her like a criminal. She somehow got bulldogged to the floor with a knee in her back. Bear in mind, this is a 45-year-old woman, small boned. She was about 5'7", about 105 pounds. I'm assuming that she was small, petite, and very brittle. The photos I've seen of her and the surveillance videos I've seen suggest that this is a woman who is not made of the strongest material. Here she is surrounded by four burly police officers, one of whom has his knee in her back while they're cuffing her hands behind her back and then dragging her away to a detention cell. Of course, the whole time she's screaming at the top of her lungs. Among other things, she is screaming, "I'm an American, not a blanking terrorist." And so she's taken to a detention cell and putting up what resistance she can on the way there. She has her hands cuffed behind her wrists. By this time, her husband had contacted the airport trying to find out what was going on with his wife. He was frantic, understandably so. She was taken to the detention cell while he was trying to contact the police. At some point, she had her hands cuffed to a bench. Bear in mind, once again, her hands are cuffed behind her back. The handcuffs were fastened by a 16-inch chain to the bench in the detention cell. Nobody was posted with her in the detention cell. It should have been
hold that thought. We'll be right back here in just a moment. Here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Chris William is telling us this tragic story of this woman, and she is certainly on the verge of a nervous breakdown. She has alcohol problems, and she has certainly a nervous breakdown in the airport there in Tucson, and of course she's trying to get on a flight. And when she starts to wail and cry, why, instead of course consoling her, why, she's forced on the floor, her hands are handcuffed behind her, she's dragged to a detention cell, she's chained to a bench with her hands handcuffed behind her. Now, this is a woman who's got an emotional problem. Mm-hmm. It should be obvious to everybody that,
yeah,
that the last thing is she is not a terrorist, she does not to be treated like a criminal. And, of course, what they're doing is just aggravating the situation.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
It seems to me that anybody with an IQ north of a rutabaga, even somebody whose IQ is south of a rutabaga, say somebody who's just a little smarter than Sean Hannity, should be able to figure out that this woman had severe emotional problems. You were not dealing with a terrorist, a criminal, or a security threat. You were dealing with a woman who is having a medical problem. That should have been obvious to anybody who was on the scene and paying attention to what was going on. Several eyewitnesses, people who were vendors, TSA officials, airline officials, people who were passing through on their way to connecting flights, said that it was pretty clear that you were dealing with a woman who was emotionally distraught and probably suffering from a medical condition. One of the passengers was interviewed by CNN a couple of days after the event, and he said that the police executed a football tackle and took her to the floor. The Phoenix police have released a small snippet of footage taken from a great distance of the arrest of Carol Ann Gottbaum. There are, of course, probably five or six other cameras that would give you a better angle as to what exactly happened here. but it was clear that she was taken down. There was an eyewitness who was a member of the TSA team there, somebody who's another government employee, so presumably he's somebody whose word we can trust, at least from the perspective of saying he's giving testimony against interest as a fellow government employee. He said the police took her down. The police spokesman was saying that she sagged to the floor, and you have two eyewitnesses here. One works for the government, the other does not. The other works for a living in an honest occupation. They both said that she was taken down by the police. But she was dragged off to this detention cell. It should be clear that she was somebody suffering from a medical and psychological problem and not a criminal, yet her hands were cuffed behind her back, which is a violent and very traumatic thing for somebody who's never been arrested, particularly to go through. She was chained to a bench with a 16-inch chain, according to the police account. Nobody was left in the detention cell with her. By the time that her husband was able to get through to the police and to tell them that they were dealing with somebody who was a potential powder keg here, emotionally, and that they were, as he put it, really playing with fire, that she was suicidal, they had to deal with her with great deference and care. By the time he got through, she was dead. She died after 10 or 15 minutes in the cell. The official account is that she strangled herself on her handcuffs, which I am confident to the point almost of a theological certainty did not happen.
I mean, it's pretty hard when your handcuffs are, your hands are handcuffed behind you to strangle yourself, you know, with your own handcuffs.
Exactly. I the memory of man runs not to a time when that's actually been done. To the best of my knowledge, nobody has ever managed to strangle himself with a pair of handcuffs.
Yeah, but the handcuffs are behind them. But see, the problem is that the police tend to cover for one another,
yeah.
And they lie. And you've got to have police officers who are honest and straightforward and abide by the law. And of course, that if there's a mistake made, you admit a mistake, but you do not come up with the situation that they strangle themselves with their handcuffed behind them. So obviously, you cannot believe anything these police officers are saying.
Yeah, I mean, when they tell you something, when their opening sortie is something which is so manifestly implausible to the point of being obviously untrue, you know you cannot trust anything that they're saying unless it's independently corroborated.
But, of course, the trouble is that then the entire police force joins together, the thin blue line, and they all lie. At least many of them will lie. And unless you can get an independent investigation, and sometimes you do have responsible police forces that will investigate things of this sort. But what about the Phoenix police force?
Well, the Phoenix police force, as a matter of fact, policing in Maricopa County, Arizona in general, has a bad reputation for people coming to lethal harm while they're in custody. Joe Arpaio, the self-described toughest sheriff in the country, is notorious for people dying in his tent city prison complex there in Maricopa County. There have been five or six people who've died unnecessarily, whether you're talking about people who were restrained in ways that suffocated them, people who died, there are at least two cases I can recall off the top of my head, of people who died when they were not given their medication. I think one was a diabetic, and I believe the other one had a blood pressure condition. But if you're arrested for a violation of some municipal ordinance governing public conduct, it shouldn't be a death sentence. If you're a drunk driver, if you're drunk and disorderly, if you do something that doesn't involve actually a capital crime against another human being, obviously you should not face capital punishment. And yet, half a dozen or eight or ten, I'm trying to remember the exact figure, I've written about it in the past, people who have been taken into custody by Joe Arpaio's sheriff's department there in Maricopa County have died needlessly through what we have to call malign neglect at best or outright abuse at worst. And this is the second time this year that the Phoenix Police Department has had a woman die, an emotionally disturbed woman suffering from a diagnosed psychological problem die as a result of an airport arrest. Earlier this year, there was a 70-year-old woman by the name of Doris Watson who was in a car with her daughter. Doris Watson, a 70-year-old woman, suffered from bipolar disorder. She was off from medication, and I don't know to what extent medication actually helps a condition of that sort, but it certainly exacerbated the condition she was in, that she had gone off her meds of her own volition without clinical supervision, and she was having an argument with her daughter while they were in the parking lot at the Sky Harbor Airport in Phoenix. Some helpful citizen dialed 911, hearing Doris screaming. So the police showed up, and they ordered the woman who was screaming out of the car. They were going to arrest Doris Watson there for the supposed crime of screaming at her daughter. She refused to get out of the car, so they manhandled her out of the car, threw her face down on the sidewalk. One of the officers once again put a knee in the back of the 70-year-old grandmother and started to handcuff her. She started to go into cardiac arrest. When the paramedics showed up, the police very helpfully informed the paramedics that she was faking as she expired there on the sidewalk. That happened on March 13th of this year. Then on September 28th, you have the episode here with Caroline Gottbaum, who died while in the custody of the Phoenix Police Department in a detention cell, a holding cell, while her husband is frantically calling the police. Now, the part of this that really sticks in my craw, as revealed in this very long police report, is that while her husband, while Noah Gottbaum, was frantically trying to find out what was going on with his wife after his wife had already died in police custody, needlessly, there was no reason to arrest her, there was no reason to handcuff her, there was no reason to detain her, and now she was dead. The police kept putting him off, kept feeding him evasive answers. They did this for 10, 15, 20 minutes or longer. And in the interim, these same people are attending to the details of ordering the Chinese food for delivery that they are going to have shipped into the airport holding cell there, where this woman has just died. I mean, they're paying more attention to the side dishes they're going to order with the Chinese entrees than they were paying to this 45-year-old non-violent mother, this horribly sick, anxious, depressed, desperate mother who committed no crime. They didn't pay any attention to her, but they made sure that they got their spring rolls with their mugu gai pan. That's the magnitude of crude, vulgar, malignant neglect that illustrates is beyond description, at least on a family radio show. But it gets even worse than that when you recognize that there has to be some element of institutional dishonesty at work here when they would concoct a story that really, according to the physical laws that govern our universe, would be impossible. I simply cannot see how a woman who's got her hands cuffed behind her back with those cuffs secured by a 16-inch chain can somehow manipulate the handcuffs over her head and then strangle herself with them, particularly, and this is a very important point, when an eyewitness that the attorney representing the Gottbaum family is desperate to have the police interview, an eyewitness saw that she was passing out when she was taken into custody in the detention cell. She was apparently already practically unconscious by the time that they had her there in the holding pen, and so it seems entirely unlikely that she'd be capable of the type of exertions necessary in order to strangle herself.
Well, of course, what actually happened? Did they do an autopsy on her, and what was the decision of the autopsy? And weren't there a lot of... Wasn't she covered with bruises?
Yes, she was covered with bruises, which is to be expected if you have a scrum of large, burly guys take you to the ground and then kneel on you and otherwise traumatize you, you're going to have your body covered with bruises. The autopsy results aren't going to be available for a couple of weeks, and in defiance of the family's wishes, the Phoenix authorities went ahead with their own official autopsy, and they have withheld certain body parts from the independent forensic pathologist who wants to perform an independent postmortem to find out what really happened here. There are all kinds of things that could have happened. I originally thought that it was possible that in the initial arrest, where she was thrown to the ground and then you had these people yanking her arms behind her back and somebody kneeling on her back, that maybe somebody had punctured a lung and that she ended up dying as a result of some kind of complications from that condition. I don't know. That's just a shot in the dark. Eyewitness said that she was screaming as she was led away. I don't think if she had a punctured lung, she would have been screaming. But it's entirely possible that she suffered a fatal injury in the initial arrest and that... 20 minutes later, she was dead as a result of that initial trauma.
Well, obviously, there is a cover-up here on the part of the Phoenix Police Department, and somebody should investigate. Mistakes can be made. Sometimes
yeah.
There are people in the police force who should not be there, but were these police or were these certainly part of the airport security?
I'm sorry, I missed the
point. Were these police or were these airport
security? No, they were police. They were from the Phoenix Police Department. They weren't airport security.
All right, we'll be back in just a moment with Mr. William Grigg.
You know, one of the things that a lot of people don't appreciate, even within law enforcement, is the fact that once an arrest takes place, the subject of that arrest is now a prisoner, and as a prisoner is entirely the moral, legal, and civil responsibility of the police officer who takes that person into custody, and then the police department represented by that police officer. There's a terrific essay explaining that principle on police1.com, which is a website that publishes essays and analyses that are intended for the professional guidance of law enforcement officers. This was sent to me by a friend of mine who's a New York City police detective, and also he describes himself as a paleoconservative or paleolibertarian. He's the sort of a person who's more comfortable discussing, for instance, the writings of Ludwig von Mises or Friedrich Hayek, rather than turning on Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity for guidance. And he's somebody who's about my age, maybe a few years younger, and he's very concerned about the cultural changes that are taking place in law enforcement. It's his opinion, and I think this is a sound opinion, that there are many, many people who are in law enforcement for the right reasons. They want to protect individual rights and property from criminals who threaten them. But unfortunately, there is this cultural change that is sweeping not only the administrations of police departments, but also the people who are the recruiting pool from whom law enforcement trainees and officers are drawn. But this essay by Gary T. Krugowitz is entitled In Your Care and Custody, When Police Officers Become Corrections Officers. He says the following: we need to remember that when police officers take a prisoner into custody, they have just become short-term corrections or custody officers. This statement sometimes surprises street officers who often don't understand all the implications of having a prisoner in their custody. It doesn't matter whether you are a police officer transporting a prisoner from a street arrest scene, a police officer picking up a prisoner for court, a police officer transporting a sick inmate, a detective taking a prisoner out of lockup to a remote site for an interview, or an airport police officer holding a person for transport. You are now responsible for that prisoner's care and well-being. Understanding this concept will keep you safer, both physically and legally. Police officers, once you take a subject into custody, that person becomes a prisoner. He or she is now in custody, and you are totally responsible for their care and well-being until such time as you request additional assistance and find other law enforcement, medical health care professionals, or mental health professionals to assist you, or are able to turn the prisoner over to other appropriate public safety professionals. In other words, you are it. You need to understand this and understand how to do your job properly, legally, and safely. And he goes on to explain, first of all, you need to understand that prisoners in custody have a new set of rights based on their status as a prisoner. They are in your care and custody, and you are responsible for them until you can turn them over to someone else. For a street officer, this is usually a corrections facility, but it could be a hospital and or mental health facility, or in some cases to a responsible adult. While the prisoner is in your care and custody, you need to understand a basic correctional concept referred to as first responder philosophy. He goes on to elaborate in some detail what that means in practical terms, but the moral principle here is very clear. He makes a point of repeating this several times. They are in your care and custody. You are morally responsible, legally responsible, civilly liable for the treatment of this individual who is now helpless. Carol Ann Gottbaum was helpless during this entire episode. Granted, her behavior was disruptive. Her language was apparently vulgar and abusive.
Hold that thought right there. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan William is simply saying that a police officer is responsible. Once he arrests that individual is his responsibility, and their care, their well-being is his responsibility. And it didn't matter whether this woman had an emotional problem and she may be verbally abusive, that he should have certainly tried to get medical care for her, or psychiatric care for her, or he should have recognized what was going on. And the fact that she was actually chained in her cell to a bench, and then of course she ends up dead, somebody's responsible. Certainly this was not a heart attack, was not spontaneous. We're told that it was she strangled herself accidentally with her handcuffs, which were handcuffed behind her back. Now, it's obvious they're not telling the truth. So once you begin to get police forces beginning to cover up the truth, a mistake is made, fine, that it should be dealt with. But this obviously is far more than a mistake. It suggests corruption at the highest level of the police department, which is covering up a crime. And that, of course, is unconscionable. Go right ahead.
Well, if you credit their account, if you assume that somehow this woman had the unique set of athletic gifts that permitted her to do something that no normal human being could do, she was somehow miraculously fit, double-jointed, and of an elastic constitution, if you assume that that's what happened, that does not exonerate the Phoenix PD, because they had a positive legal, moral, and civil responsibility to ensure that she was safe once she was helpless and in their custody. That's the point that Mr. Krugerwitz is making here in this essay for PoliceOne.com.
And of course the other question is, why, once she's in a cell, why didn't they take off the handcuffs? Why leave her handcuffed when she is in a cell?
Why
in fact, the whole idea of handcuffing people immediately is to dehumanize them, to make them have a feeling of being totally helpless and subservient to the police officers. But once they're in a cell, it's an entirely different ballgame.
Exactly. There was no reason to have her cuffed to the cell, much less cuffed to that bench. I honestly think that if they had done that same thing to a dog, they would have been liable for charges of inhumane treatment of animals. But you've got a 45-year-old mother of three. As far as I'm able to tell, she had no criminal record of any sort whatsoever who was treated that way. And bear in mind, what was the source of her breakdown? Her breakdown was triggered by the fact that she was being treated as if she were a terrorist. It's a security breach if you use this guy's boarding pass to get on this regional jet. She was trying to get help. There was a uniquely bad set of circumstances here that put her into a position where she was completely helpless. And what put her over the edge was this palpable sense of pervasive oppression that characterizes every airport you go to now. You are a suspect. If you're flying as a law-abiding, innocent American citizen, you're a suspect. You're treated like a prisoner. Our airports are literally operated like prison. And about 22 years ago, in my former life as a musician, I actually performed twice at Leavenworth, the military penitentiary there in Kansas. And in order to do so, it was necessary that each of us present a photo ID and go through a metal detector and go through a fairly invasive body search in order to get into Leavenworth and to get out of Leavenworth. In other words, in order to go into this maximum security military prison, we went through exactly the same set of security protocols that you have to go through in order to go on a domestic flight, commercial flight here in the United States. There are some people like myself who simply will not put up with this. I will not fly commercially anymore. I simply won't have anything to do with an airport, apart from perhaps going there to rent a car. And that's becoming more difficult, too. That's becoming something very unpleasant because of some collateral security measures that are going into effect. And pretty soon, as the real ID system goes online and we have a national ID card, I suspect that it's going to become very difficult to drive anywhere in this country. If you have a non-real ID driver's license, if you live in a state, the legislature of which has decided that it will not take part in this real ID program, I honestly believe that within a couple of years, the federal government's going to require states that are part of the program not to recognize the validity of driver's licenses issued by non-real ID states, which means that if you're stopped for a traffic infraction, you're arrested for driving without a license.
Well, I think what they're trying to do is, of course, intimidate the states, and
they're
saying, of course, we're not going to force you to do this, but if you don't do it, all of your citizens will be punished. They won't be able to fly on airplanes without a passport, or they won't be able to drive in other states without a passport, or maybe not drive at all. And it is this idea that all of these things are justified because it's a fellow in a cave over in Pakistan who threatens to take away our freedom. And that's why we've got to, of course, everybody's going to have an ID card. We're going to have dossiers on every citizen. We're going to have, of course, video cameras, certainly at intersections of the freeways and department stores and convenience stores, in banks and ATMs. We've got, of course, have a total surveillance society to protect us from Osama bin Laden, who's hiding in a cave over there in Pakistan. We'll be right back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Go ahead and pick the story up there with him.
You know, it's interesting to me that more people have been killed, more innocent women specifically have been killed in the Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport by the police than have been killed by Al-Qaeda. You have two of them who have been killed just this year. Carol Ann got bombed just a couple of weeks ago, and then Doris Watson on March 13th. And what drove Carol Ann Gottbaum over the edge was, once again, the fact that she was being treated as a terrorist. So what do the police do to calm her down? They surround her, they tell her they're going to take her under arrest, they handcuff her behind her back, and they chain her to a bench as if she were a detainee at Gitmo. That's exactly the type of treatment that you read about and can learn about that is afforded to those who are arrested, detained, renditioned, or otherwise delivered into the custody of the people running Gitmo. They are chained to the floor. That's the treatment that Carol Ann Gottbaum received. I wouldn't be surprised if she simply had a coronary infarct from the way that she had been treated. I mean, just the combination of mishaps and malicious behavior she experienced that day might have been enough to give her a heart attack, especially if you're dealing with somebody who was severely clinically depressed. I mean, to the point where she was suicidal. I don't know enough about the relevant physiology here to offer an informed opinion, much less an expert one. But that's a possibility. Once again, if she simply expired while in that holding cell, that is the direct liability, or rather the Phoenix Police Department is directly liable for that. It's the direct responsibility of the Phoenix PD.
Well, of course, there's all the difference. I mean, anybody doing an autopsy knows whether the patient died of a coronary infarction or whether they were strangled to death. And certainly, you know, so obviously the people who've done the autopsy have a pretty good idea. It doesn't take you weeks to come up with the diagnosis. And the fact that they're withholding information from the forensic pathologist who's been hired by the family would suggest they're covering up something.
Yeah.
If she had died of a heart attack, it would be very, very straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
What are they concealing? Why are they concealing it? And who is responsible for the cover-up? That, I think, is the frightening thing to contemplate. If we can't trust the police, who can we trust?
Yeah. It's gotten to the point now where I am of the opinion that we cannot trust the police in any set of circumstances. Not because there aren't good policemen. I know many of them. I've got friends, high school and college classmates, who are patrol officers, motorcycle cops, beat policemen who work as police detectives. I mentioned one of them in a previous segment. I know a lot of people...
Hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we're certainly talking with our good friend William Grigg. And before we go on with the story of the tragic death of this woman in the Phoenix police, the Phoenix airport, William, I want you to give your blog site and how people can get your writings and the material that you have out there.
Well, a lot of the material that we've been reviewing this evening has been published on my blog, which is entitled Pro Libertate. That's a Latin expression that means for freedom. The easiest way to find my blog, which is updated between 4 and 6 times a week, is to go to the news site for which I serve as an editor at large. That news site is called The Right Source. The address for it on the web is www.rightsourceonline.com. One word, rightsourceonline.com. And that'll take you to the right source, which is updated pretty much 2 or 3 times a day with news and opinions and now videos as well, video links. You go to the Right Source Online, take a look at the top of the screen, scroll down about a third of the way down the page, take a look at the left-hand side of the screen, you'll find my photograph. Look immediately to the right of my photograph. There are 2 links. Go to the furthest one to the right, and it'll take you to my blog, Pro Libertate. And that blog, at the bottom of every essay that I publish on that blog, there's a link as well to the radio commentaries that I do that are called the Liberty Minutes. They're done, once again, 5 times a week. They're 1-minute segments to talk about topics of interest in the freedom struggle. And I think that when we're talking about the police issue particularly, that's something I've been paying a lot of attention to. And I want to reiterate, it's not because I have any instinctive animus toward police as police. My problem is this cultural change that I described where pretty much the dominant tenet of the modern police philosophy, the first thing that police recruits are indoctrinated in is the concept of officer safety. And they're acculturated into a mindset in which the public at large is looked upon with suspicion and hostility. And so you end up with spectacles like that of a frail 45-year-old mother of three who's obviously suffering a breakdown and not committing a crime, being surrounded by four large, burly Phoenix Police Department officers, with one of them putting a knee into his back as she's having her hands cuffed behind her back. You're right about the fact that that's intended to degrade, dehumanize, and to make helpless the suspect. It's meant to assert control and dominance. And that's another element of the mindset that is completely foreign to the way that peace officers used to comport themselves, not even a generation ago. It used to be that peace officers tried to de-escalate situations, not to achieve dominance. But now the mantra is to control and make them submit. And that's a military point of view. The way that the military approaches a situation is to achieve what is called full-spectrum dominance of a given theater. And that's the mindset of the police now. It wasn't that way, I'd be willing to bet, even 25 years ago when I was in high school. I don't think the police approach things quite that way.
Well, you know, I think it's so obvious when we watch television. Now we notice the militarization of our police and how often it is when the hero in the television program is going to go to somebody's home. They've got a SWAT team with them, and their SWAT team has their automatic rifles there, and they have their helmets, they have their body armor on, and of course they don't just simply knock on the door to present a warrant. No, they break the war down. They go in with their guns raised, and of course, if anybody puts an objection, they sometimes they shoot them, sometimes they don't, but it is this whole idea of the militarization of our police. Oh my goodness, that we have to do this because the gangs are, you know, they've got all these weapons. We can't have the police being outgunned. But lots of times, you know, for instance, was an instance we've talked about before,
mm-hmm.
some poor little woman, sitting at home, minding her own business, when the police break down the door, three big burly officers come in with guns drawn. They do not announce their police. This woman is in an area where she's concerned about crime. She has a pistol. She shoots, and actually she wounds all three of them. And I don't know, she ends up with how many bullets in her. They kill her. They got the wrong house.
Yeah.
But what is done to the police officers for getting the wrong house? Well, it wasn't their fault. It was the informant giving the wrong information.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just then the police officer is then exonerated because it was just a mistake. Well, it's how you approach people. If you go in and you knock on the door, but they say, well, if we knock on the door, they might try to escape, or they might try to flush the drugs down the toilet. But we have to remember we're dealing with American citizens,
mm-hmm.
and every American citizen is not guilty. He is innocent until proven guilty.
Well, the case you just described was that of Katherine Johnson, who was a 92-year-old woman in Atlanta. She lived literally hard on the border between a neighborhood that was marginally civilized and one that was not. And the officers who made that arrest are actually facing criminal charges, but the initial reaction on the part of the Atlanta police force and the mayor of Atlanta was to stand behind the police officers who unloaded something like 30 or 40 rounds into the body of this barely mobile 92-year-old woman who lived in a home that had burglar bars on the door, and she'd given a revolver by her daughter for home protection. Police never presented a warrant, never identified themselves. For all she knew, she was dealing with a bunch of gangbangers. The police, after the fact, suborned an informant, a low-level drug pusher of the sort who are very frequently employed by police departments to carry out missions of this sort. They suborned this informant into perjuring himself, saying that he had purchased marijuana at that address earlier that day. And all this, of course, came out in the wash after about a week of really forceful, intransigent, stubborn, refractory stonewalling by the police department there in Atlanta. What I find really interesting about that case is I looked into it a little bit, and I don't know if anybody else has done this, but there was a report that was commissioned for the government of the city of Atlanta about 4 or 5 years ago called Fragile Momentum. That report talked about the idea that you had to impress on the mind of the public in Atlanta that there was a drug problem, that there was a problem of violent crime. They didn't understand how big the problem was, and so in order to create an impression in the minds of the citizens of Atlanta that they were under siege by the criminals, they had to have a more conspicuous law enforcement presence. That really strikes me as perverse. I mean, you literally have the police out there to create the impression in the minds of the citizens of Atlanta that they are under siege by criminals. Well, to what end? Well, so that you can get more money for the city government in order to have a larger, more robust police force. The police actually going out and drumming up business for themselves. And there was a strike force created called Red Dog, run every drug dealer out of Georgia. And they weren't actually going to be running every drug dealer out of Georgia. That's an impossible thing to do. If you're an inmate in any prison in this country, you can get narcotics of any kind, any time you want, in any quantity you desire. If you create a literal prison society, you're not going to eliminate the admittedly horrible problem of drug addiction. There's going to be between, I think, 3% and 5% of the population that will become addicted to drugs no matter what we do. So obviously you're not going to eradicate the problem. You have to find ways of dealing with it, of treating it as a social problem rather than as a pretext for militarizing the police, which is what was going on in Atlanta, which has happened across the country pretty much. And the rationale for these no-knock drug searches that you're talking about is exactly the idea that if they don't barge in with guns drawn and force people face first on the floor, the people are going to be getting rid of evidence. You know, I would vastly prefer that people be flushing their drugs down the toilet. If the drugs are flushed down the toilet, then the immediate problem is solved. But, of course, that's not the way it works in this murderous farce we call the war on drugs. Seizures of this sort are lucrative for a number of reasons, not the least of which is that through the Burn Grant program, which is operated by the Justice Department, you get huge amounts of money from the federal government, you know, extorted from taxpayers in other states, for your police forces if you go out and have enforcement actions of this sort that actually end up yielding something in terms of seized contraband. And, of course, there's the civil asset forfeiture. If you can somehow connect somebody's property to the drug trade, however distant and attenuated the connection, you can confiscate anything of value that that person owns, including seizing his bank account or seizing any cash you happen to find. We talked, I think, last week about what was going on in Chicago with this special operations service that they'd put together, which I'm happy to say is now being disbanded. You know, many hundreds of police officers are part of this sort of SWAT force on steroids, and many of them just became straight-up, undisguised, unalloyed gangsters, shaking down people on the streets, forcing people to take them back to their homes so they could rifle through their belongings and find any cash or valuables that might be worthwhile, and then putting up bogus drug charges against people so as to make sure that they couldn't do anything to get their property back. Well, this is a huge scandal. It's gotten nowhere near as much attention as it deserves, but one hopeful development here is the fact that that wretched and inexcusable SOS unit is being disbanded now because of the public outcry in Chicago. I suspect that what's going to happen is they're simply going to break it up and elements of it are going to be put off into various other SWAT or tactical teams there that are attached to the Chicago Police Department. The Chicago Police Department has been an awful police department for decades. I mean, it was actually better run when Al Capone was the de facto ruler of Chicago than it's being run today, which is a really sad commentary on things. But that's, I think, paradigmatic of what we're seeing here in terms of the drug war has completely corrupted law enforcement. It was intended to. It was intended to bring about a cultural change that would involve the militarization of police and the destruction of the legal immunities and protections that law-abiding citizens enjoy or the criminal suspects should enjoy in our system. I mean, until you're proven guilty by a preponderance of evidence, as you pointed out, Dr. Stan, you're innocent. You're innocent before the law. And peace officers understood that back when we had them.
Well, I think that this is really sort of a byproduct of the training of our police officers today. I think an awful lot of them are trying to do a good job.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, I think there some of them, you'll always find some very bad eggs there, and some people who sort of want to be like Dirty Harry, you know, and he's out there on the front lines, you know, and he's got a gun in his hand, and he's really something really, very important. I think that some people are taken to the police force because they like to be able to be in charge. They like to be able, you know, to have a gun and to force other people to do things. And those are the ones that we really have to be concerned about. The problem is that when we have officers like that, many times why they're being covered for by other officers are because of this idea of we're all in this together.
Yeah,
you cannot take that attitude. If somebody is abusing their right as a police officer, then they've got to get rid of him, or all police officers are discredited. We need responsible police. We need good police officers. We used to have them, but there's a conscious effort to militarize our police and give them the idea that the people are the enemy, and they're there, of course, to do good.
One really good example of what you're talking about here is the case of this Tyler Peterson kid in Crandon, Wisconsin. Crandon, Wisconsin is a tiny community, and I think it's fewer than 2,000 people who live there. It's up in the northern part of the state next to a little town called Rhinelander. I used to spend some time up in the north woods of Wisconsin. I'm vaguely familiar with that area. But last Sunday morning, this 20-year-old sheriff's deputy, full-time sheriff's deputy and part-time police officer, 20 years old, he was made a sheriff's deputy on September 11th of last year when he was 19 years old, walked into a party, and using his AR-15 rifle he had been given by the sheriff's department, killed six of them and seriously wounded the seventh. And apparently what had happened is he'd gone to this party, and these are former classmates, I should point out. These are people he knew from high school. One of them was his ex-girlfriend with whom he had a fight. And somehow, in the course of that fight, he was called a worthless pig, so he went out to his pickup truck and retrieved his sheriff's department-issued AR-15 and sprayed 30 rounds or more, killing six of these people and wounding a seventh before going off and eventually being tracked down by other law enforcement from the area and dying in a gun battle. We don't know whether he took his own life or whether he was killed by another law enforcement officer. That detail's not emerged yet. What we do know from interviews with people who knew him is that he was the sort of a person who was very difficult to deal with in high school, from accounts I've read, because he had an appetite for dominating other people. And so at a very callow age, at an age when young men tend to be rather power hungry, you know, 19-year-old, I remember what I was like in 19. I'm astonished that I was considered fit for civilized society at age 19. I'm only marginally fit for civilized society at 44.
Oh, no, Chris, that isn't true, but go ahead.
But he was somebody who already had an appetite for dominating others, and one of his friends said, well, he just became insufferable. Once he became a deputy sheriff, he went on a huge power trip, and obviously that was the case because he ended up using this civilian equivalent of an M16 military rifle to kill these people. What I find interesting about that is that if you take a look at what's going on in a number of departments, the Miami Police Department being a really good example, they're now issuing the so-called assault weapons. The AR-15, with certain modifications, was called an assault weapon in the 1994 gun ban, the assault weapons ban that the Clinton administration ran through. When it's in the hands of a civilian, it's called an assault weapon. When it's in the hands of a police officer, the media are instructed to call it a patrol rifle because it's magically somehow sanctified by being in the hands of people who exercise coercive power on behalf of the state, people like Tyler Peterson, who went out off-duty, killed six of his classmates. John Timoney, by the way, the police chief of Miami, is the guy who developed what is called the Miami model for riot control. And some of your listeners might have seen the footage from the FTAA riots. There weren't any riots, there were protests. They were actually protests that became riots because of the aggressive activities of the police back in 2003, where you had these black-clad, stormtrooper-looking riot police who were hurling rubber bullets at peaceful, relatively sedate demonstrators.
But, of course, you know, the other problem with that, really, William, is that they're a very easy way to hold, to control crowds. I mean, they used to use fire hoses. They only didn't have to have the people dressed up like, looking like Darth Vader with their, you know, with their helmets and their batons. You use fire hoses and put a little soap in the water, and as the people can't stand up, and But that's effective. They don't want an effective thing. They want the confrontation. They want the police officers a beating in the heads of the people. Because this, of course, serves the purpose, you know, of turning the people against the police,
mm-hmm.
but also turning the police against the people. So yeah. instead of using the long used methods, they've outlawed the use of fire hoses, or we couldn't do that, it's inhumane. You just go ahead and you know, they send these people out with their face shields, dressed like Darth Vader, and let people be hit over the head or hit with rubber bullets. They want to create the problem. This is what people don't understand. Many times the police are victims of this thing, but
mm-hmm.
of course I
True.
Share your concern that sometimes we have people in the police force who really shouldn't be there, who have forgotten the fact that they are there to serve the people and to protect the people, and not to consider them as enemies or everyone a potential drug dealer, and we've got to get those drug dealers. We're going to be back in just a moment with William Grigg, the wrap of this evening's program. Always loads of fun. Well, William, we've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Well, you mentioned this dialectic that's been going on now for a generation or two, where in the 60s, the riots were engineered in such a way as to turn public opinion against the police. And what has happened in the interim is that the police were turned against the public. And now the dialectical synthesis here is that basically the public is afraid of the police are afraid of the public. And the police, of course, right now enjoy the advantage of being essentially a military standing army of occupation, rather than being the peace officer force that they once were, even a generation or so ago. That's the dialectical synthesis, the process you're describing. One other thing I'd like to point out, of course, is that you cannot overlook the fact that almost every large demonstration is going to be honeycombed with provocateurs and informants. We saw up in Canada during the SPP conference in Montbello just a couple of months ago, this really fascinating footage of three guys who are obviously not college-age people. They were, you know, very large, husky, middle-aged men who were there from the Canadian Security Force. And they had their faces covered with bandanas. They were dressed as if they were anarchists, and they were talking about throwing rocks and bricks at the riot police. And they were exposed there by a labor leader who made a point of saying, get away from here. This is a peaceful demonstration. You have nothing to do with us. You're a bunch of police provocateurs. Get away from here. They were busted on camera, you know, in real time. It was really quite good. It was a very delightful spectacle to see the settlement, because they'd gone off script. Nobody knew what to do. You know, they were busted. But that sort of thing happens almost every time you have a large demonstration. That's part of the process we're describing here as well. This dialectic intended to bring about this totalitarian synthesis that we're now dealing with here. And so I think it's important that we recognize that when somebody shows up and starts urging you to take violent action that's ensured to be provocative, you're almost certainly dealing with somebody who's a planted provocateur. That's a very important thing to remember.
Yeah, and I agree with you totally. I mean, but it's a terrible situation when
yeah.
we have the government actually hiring provocateurs out there trying to get people to violate
yeah.
the law. If somebody comes to you, as they've often come to me on the radio, and saying, well, we're just going to have a revolution.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only way we're going to solve our problem. You know he's probably an agent of the government, and they're recording the problem.
Yes.
You never know, unfortunately today, who you can trust and who you can't. Because we have a nation of informers, and believe me, I've even been recruited, and I have other people I know who've been recruited to become informants on other Americans. Sure doesn't sound very good, does it, William?
No, it really doesn't. And every language I've ever studied, the word for informant is always a term of abuse, and for very good reason.
Anyway, we're out of time. God bless. We'll talk to you again next
God
week.
Bless.
Thanks very much for being with us. Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and we hope you enjoyed our conversations with William Grigg. If you'd like to get the entire text of what we talk about, because we do talk, of course, during the commercials, you can get the entire tape or CD by calling 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to know about the techniques that are used to turn the police against the public and the public against the police, we have a 4-tape set called The Battle in Seattle, and it went into the demonstrations up in Seattle and how the agent provocateurs were there, of course, trying to get the violence going. and how, of course, the mayor of Seattle was the one who planned the whole thing and, of course, would not let the police do what needed to be done before things got totally out of hand. The four tapes of the battle in Seattle is one of my favorites. You can get it in four tape sets or CDs. We also have a four tape set on the FBI. If we have a four tape set on, is there really a war against drugs? Because let me suggest to you, ladies and gentlemen, the war on drugs is as phony as a $3 bill. I mean, the CIA is the largest purveyor of drugs in the United States. When Gary Webb wrote that, when he was a Pulitzer Prize winning a reporter for the San Jose Mercury, they went after him, they got him fired, and eventually, of course, he committed suicide by shooting himself in the head twice to make sure he was dead. We do have a essay that Gary wrote. It's in the Into the Buzzsaw. It's a book about what happens to people in the media who tells the truth. Into the Buzzsaw. Let me recommend that book to you very strongly. And then, of course, the books Drugging America and Defrauding America by Rodney Stitz. Understand, of course, that we're not getting the truth from the media, because 95% of our media is controlled by five mega corporations, and that's covered in a book called The New Media Monopoly by Professor Ben Bekdakian. And then, of course, this is the time when we need to remind you that Radio Liberty is having an all-day seminar here on the 28th of October. We do hope that many of you will be able to come. It's going to be at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course. We're going to be serving lunch. Doors will open at 7:30 in the morning. The program will go till 5 or 5:30 in the evening. We will hope that you can come and bring your friends. I think we're going to have a great turnout again this year. We're bringing in outside speakers. It'll be a great program. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And if you can get other people to come, to introduce them to this idea that so much of what's going on really doesn't make sense. There really are powerful spiritual forces that are energizing so much of what is going on today, and their ultimate goal is a one-world government, a one-world religion, and a one-world leader. And if you want, of course, to get their material, we'll be glad to show you where you can go on the Internet. You go to lucistrust.org. www.lucistrust.org. Read everything on their website. They'll tell you who runs the world. The Ancients of Wisdom, the Elder Brothers, the Spiritual Hierarchy, they're all one and the same. They are beings, of course, from the other dimension, who dominate so much of what's going on today. And some of the richest and most powerful people in the world are on the board of directors, are working with the Lucis Trust. And if you go to some of their organizations, like the New Group of World Servers, and see who finances them, some of the richest and most powerful men in America today, or their foundations do. So our telephone number again, 1-800-544-8927. If you want to verify anything we're saying, well, we'd be glad to provide you the verification for this. Understand, this is not imaginary. The story is so incredible, most people find it difficult to believe. There really could be organizations up on the Internet with websites talking about the spiritual hierarchy that controls the world? Well, yes, of course, and you can get their pamphlets. In fact, if you'd like the pamphlet on the spiritual hierarchy, we'll be glad to send you one. These people know exactly what they're doing. They hope you will never understand until it is too late. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. Don't forget our all-day seminar on the 28th of October. Pray for America. Pray for revival. But please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection.